I turn back to the stage to take a photo and turn back to him to say, oh my gosh, isn't this amazing? And I watch the person directly behind him be shot straight through the face.
The following podcast is a Carolina Boys production. Welcome back, everyone, to Crime and Entertainment. I'm your host, Hollywood Wade. Now, today, if you heard that opener, I have a really emotional episode for you guys. That was Ashley Hoff. Ashley Hoff was actually in attendance at the Route 91 Harvest Festival in Las Vegas 6 years ago, anniversary recently just passed, when a shooter opened fire from a high-rise area of the Mandalay Bay Casino right into a group of concert goers. One of the more horrifying things I'd ever watched at that time. You know, to put it in perspective, 9/11 might have been the only thing that was even close to, you know, the tragedy that was unfolding there. Ashley was right in the middle of that, barely escaped with her life, and she lets us kind of peek into everything she experienced that day. And she's also the executive producer of a film called 11 Minutes that can be streamed on Paramount Plus. I urge everyone to go check that out if you have not seen it. It is an excellent documentary. Much of it is actual footage from cell phones from the night of this event. So let's get right into it here on Crime and Entertainment with Ashley Hoff. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Crime and Entertainment. We have here today a very special guest. I heard her story on Collier Landry's podcast and Tara Newell, Survivor Squad, I believe is the name of it. And I was just blown away by the detail in her story. Then come to find out she's actually got a documentary about the story we're going to get into today. And a congratulations are in order because this documentary, from what I understand, has just been nominated for an Emmy. Is that correct? And by the way, it's Ashley Hoff.
Yeah, no, it is. We just found out this past week that we are nominated for an Emmy Award. And it's just so exciting, which is a hard word to say about subject matter like this. But right. It feels like such a blessing to have taken the approach we did, which was to shine a light on the light that was in the darkness and not focus on, which I think sometimes in media can so often happen, the drama or why the shooter did what he did, but why really stories of how humanity truly showed up for each other that night, and to see the recognition on behalf of that type of storytelling, and as well as, you know, the opportunity to continue to honor the resiliency of the survivor community, to share what it means to be a survivor of an event like this. Mm-hmm. And also to continue to honor the families who were so deeply touched by this, and our 58 angels. It feels really big. It feels really big. And I'm really grateful.
Wow. I'm extremely happy I was able to view that documentary. Tell our audience real quick, because we've kind of jumped right in here. Give us a little 2-minute primer on who you are and then kind of what has brought us to this point. And then we'll kind of backtrack and start with your story, because your story isn't in this documentary. You've kind of been running things from behind the scenes. So I think it's important here. We'll get into your story and then we'll kind of guide people to the documentary. But kind of give us a little quick primer on who Ashley Hoff is.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a unscripted television producer. I've been doing that for, the better part of a decade and a half now. So everything from, you know, true crime documentaries to lifestyle programming to food and cooking shows, you know, it really has spanned the gamut. I've been blessed to grow up in a world of development where the guise was we tell stories of great people. And so that's, I've always been a people first storyteller. And, you know, now almost 6 years ago, I was attending a country music festival. I am a Midwest baby. I'm from a small town in Iowa, and I love country music. And my then husband and I were at the festival together, and it, you know, it turned into what was one of the, you know, most tragic nights in our American history. And we certainly didn't anticipate that. And it was a, you know, a very long road. I never say the term healed. I believe in the active term healing. I think as a survivor, you get a scar like that and you wear it for the rest of your life. And right. Sometimes it's dormant and you maybe don't notice it for a few minutes. And other days it's feels like it's wide open. But yeah, I think, you know, for the 5 years to follow, what really sat on my heart as a storyteller was a dissatisfaction with how the story was being represented in the media. You know, the only point of view that had really gone fully explored was that of the worst person there, down to I could tell you what he had for breakfast at Starbucks that morning. And I always thought, why do I know that? Like, why do I know so much about this person when what I hold on to so dearly and what I remember so clearly running out of that field that night was knowing that I was bearing witness to some of the greatest accounts of humanity I was ever going to get to see, you know, people not just showing up for one another, but really truly putting their lives on the line to save a person they probably didn't know. And I thought, what a prolific opportunity to tell a story, especially in the world we live in today, where, you know, there's a lot of really hard news about a night in 2017 when, you know, it all hit the fan. No one looked around and said, hey, where are you from? What do you do? What are your politics? What's your cultural background? They just became people helping people and doing anything they could to do that. And that's the story that I felt passionate about telling, the history that I so desperately wanted the history books to remember. And so you mentioned it a little bit. My story wasn't a part of the documentary, but what a lot of people don't know is I, as a development executive, never, you know, what I do for a living is I produce sizzle reels, right? So that is, let's call it a sales trailer for a television show. Yeah. So there are little 3 to 5 minute blocks that were to get a network enthusiastic and sort of involved with the idea.
Yeah, it's your pitch to get something picked up.
Yep, it's your pitch. And so when we thought about how we were going to pitch this project, I felt very, very firmly, and my team really supported me in this manner, that I could never ask another survivor of this event to go down their story road, because it is traumatic. Whether you feel good, feel like you're fine about it today or not, it walking the road, it always brings things back up. Mm-hmm. And a lot of survivors were really mishandled by the media after this. You know, I heard terrible stories of media sleeping in funeral bathrooms and, you know, asking people to share their stories before they were ready. And I knew that if I was going to reach out to the community, that I wanted to have all of the information. I wanted to know, this is why you're doing this. I want you to feel like you feel called to do this. I want you to know what my heart is, and I want you to know the network group behind it. And so we actually utilized my story as the backbone of that sizzle reel and those sales materials. Because I never wanted to unearth anyone's trauma if it wasn't necessary and it didn't feel necessary for a, you know, quote unquote pitch. So that was a big part of it. And I feel blessed that I, you know, got to use it in some press opportunities following that. It felt good, but I felt called to be the storyteller in this instance. And I think truly it felt like It's the most useful, I guess, I've ever felt. You know, I felt like I got to be there to make sure people not only truly felt heard, and cared for while they were on set. But to be there and say, hey, I don't know everything about what you went through, but I know a little bit about it. So if you need to take a break or you don't want to talk about that, like, this is a absolutely safe space. Mm-hmm. And to sort of set that tone, you know, throughout it felt very meaningful as a producer. So, yeah, that's a little bit about how it all sort of came to be, I suppose. And we were blessed that Paramount Plus came on as our network partner, and they were wonderful through and through. Susan Zirinsky, Terry Wrong, Aisu Saliba, their team is wonderful and kind and empathetic and supported, you know, our approach and joined us as producers through and through. So it was through and through an incredible experience.
And I'll piggyback off something you just said. You know, you hit the nail on the head. When all that was over, it was just people looking out for people. Nobody gave a damn what race, what color, what side of the political fence you were on, what your pronouns were. None of that shit mattered. It was just people helping people. And the only time I can ever remember, like in my lifetime, really seeing that, because obviously I wasn't there during this shooting. You were there, so you have that perspective. But it was 9/11. It's like a tragedy has to happen to get people to remember that everybody's just people, regardless of what their beliefs are or whatever. We're all just people. And, you know, that's the last time that I can really remember where none of that mattered. We were one nation under God and everybody was helping out. And it's a shame that it has to take these types of tragedies for it to happen. But at the same time, it shows that, like, when we are attacked, when our, you know, freedom is attacked, that we will band together and we will, you know, help each other. And the documentary, and I urge everyone, after you listen to this story, to go see it. As she said, it's on Paramount Plus. It's called 11 Minutes. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. I implore everyone, you've got to see this. It's really, really moving. And it really almost puts you like as if you're there and in the audience. So I can't, you know, speak enough praises about how you guys put this all together. It was very well done. So I guess we'll just get into your story. So tell us a little bit about, like, you know, where you grew up. Were you always into film, that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. And before we hop into that, it's worth saying, cause I think you just absolutely touched on such a crucial part of what made this documentary series so different, in a lot of ways, was, you know, we were all at a concert, right? So mm-hmm. everybody had this thing out. Yep. And we were, you know, lucky that so many Route 91 survivors and family members, you know, allowed us the opportunity to utilize their footage from that evening. And so you are immersed in individual stories. And that was so important to us, that you knew that this just didn't happen to people on the news. It happened to Natalie's and Jonathan's and Ashley's and Tom's and Natalia's and Gianna's. And it, I think it allowed a connectivity and a intensity in a lot of ways. I think it's really easy to see events like this from afar and for it to be a scary thing that happens on the news until it happens to you. Mm-hmm. And in addition, the Las Vegas Metro PD and SWAT were so, and FBI were so supportive of the project and allowed us into about 700 hours of body camera footage that also takes you inside the other side of, you know, what they were doing. And
yeah, that was the great part about that too, is it wasn't just the concert viewers' perspectives. It was first responders. It was police officers. It was hospital staff. It really kind of put you in the middle of everything. You've seen it from all sides. And that's what really just drew you in. I watched everything straight through. I couldn't turn it off.
Yeah, it really did allow, you know, such an immersive experience. And as a storyteller, honestly, that's terrifying. It's terrifying to approach subject matter of this nature, because you never want to, our intention was to give some understanding to what an event like this truly looks like mm-hmm. and feels like for people, and why, you know, the number of people who have come up to me and said something as simple as, my mom has never understood why I couldn't be present for the 4th of July fireworks ever since, and has asked me why I can't just get over it. Or I've never really been able to have a conversation with my spouse. They were there that night and I wasn't, and I don't know how to relate. Or I'm a therapist that is helping me work with my first responders better. You know, it is, again, in some ways, I think crucial that you walk in someone else's shoes when it comes to the hard stuff, just as much as it is the, you know, the good things.
Yeah, 100%. So
we can all relate to each other a little bit better. And I think hopefully, you know, work to change things. I don't think anybody watches 11 minutes and is like, well, but you know what? Like, that was fine. That was fine that that happened. And that's what our goal was, is we didn't walk out to take a personal stance. We took a narrative stance in hopes that when people were done with this, that they felt called to, at the very least, be a kinder, better human on behalf of the people that they just spent 4 hours getting to meet, and what kindness, you know, was in their lives that night. It's not just something that changed it. It was a life-saving moment. So,
and it's important for that, because like you said, after this was covered, you know, nobody zeroed in on the, you know, the people that had everything happen to them at the concert. It was all about the individual that chose to do this horrific act. It was all about, you know, him and why, and which those are questions that need to be answered, you know, but at the same time, you still got a lot of people affected by this. And, you know, it did seem like, even though I remember when it, you know, was on the news, it did seem like it just, and I guess that's just the time we live in, quickly was kind of swept up under the rug. And for, and I think it still is the worst mass shooting in history.
Yeah, it is. And it has this big headline, and it truly was out of national news really within a week, you know, and you see little snippets pop up here and again, but it's always sort of on to the next headline with these things. And it feels like people get, can get hyper-focused on them for a couple of days, and then there's not really any momentum. And I think as a survivor, it starts to feel very strange. Like, it was, you're like, was that just a weird dream? Like, did that happen? Does my entire life change? And no one seems to remember that at all. And it feels so, so big to you because it was so big. So I think, you know, in a lot of ways, what I'm the most proud of is the response from the community, that they felt seen, and that this was A, that the participants were all handled obviously with care and in kindness, and that their stories were represented appropriately, but the event at large was also, you know, represented appropriately. And that's the appropriate amount of, you know, again, shining a light on the light that was in the darkness, but also reminding folks that this is a really bad thing that happened. You know, it was a really bad thing. And I think you have to sometimes record history in that manner in hopes that it doesn't repeat itself in that manner.
Oh yeah, 100%. And like you said, you had to be careful the way you went about it. You know, I don't think anyone else maybe would have came at this from all the angles that you did, you yourself being there and being a survivor of this incident. I don't think anyone else trying to from outside of that would have maybe handled it the exact way you did, which could have turned people off, which could have, you know, maybe not have them feel as ease as you did. So I think all those things really shone through in that documentary for sure.
Yeah. And listen, I think anybody can be an empathetic storyteller. I truly believe that. But I would say, you know, I would encourage people who are telling stories of this nature, whether they happened yesterday or historically, you know, previously, find a survivor to consult, because it is, it really truly is fully impossible to understand it unless you were there. And I won't understand it in, you know, the way that every other survivor did either, but I at least have a baseline. And I think having, you know, that representation on our sets and as we tell stories, I think is really important. I think it, you know, provides not just a safe space, but an authenticity and the ability for everyone from, you know, survivors to, in our case, Las Vegas Metro PD, you know, those people were all survivors too. And I think that that's where our approach really lived, was you know, even when we interviewed, you know, Jason Aldean was, you know, you're not meant to be a banner head of this event like that. Right. You too are a survivor, you know, all of those incredible police officers, SWAT team, like in there, they are survivors of that event. Like their trauma and their interaction might've been different than mine as a civilian and things like that. But they're, you know, we all share a bit of that common bond from that night. And so yeah. I don't know, I'd encourage media as they move forward to, you know, if you're going to tell a story, try to involve someone who was a part of that story. I think it's able to give you a bit of a fuller perspective.
Yeah. And Jason himself was, and one of his bandmates was really close to getting struck by those bullets. A lot of the early ones were hitting off the stage and, you know, and we'll get into it here. Nobody really knew exactly what it was at the time, but, yeah. And again, hats off to you. You guys done an excellent job for this. I guess just kind of like I said, was this always not this in particular, but was film and this thing always been something that you were into since you were young?
Yeah. You know, honestly, telling stories was something I was into. I grew up in a really small town, a stoplight, cause it was cute, you know, to talk about in town council. Yeah. It was a beautiful way to grow up. I had a very large family. I'm one of 10 kiddos from a blended family. And I always had these big dreams of getting out and seeing more. And you talked about 9/11. I did a service project when I was 16 years old after 9/11 that took me to New York City for the very first time to present a check I had raised to a fire station there and receive an honor from the police chief and fire chief. But more importantly, I remember getting off the plane and thinking, oh my gosh, like there's a whole world out here that I don't know anything about.
Oh yeah.
And It was really that moment that I realized that being brave and being kind could take me absolutely anywhere. You know, I was a small town kid. I didn't have a bunch of big city connections. And here I was standing here doing this thing. And so I, at that moment, thought, gosh, I really want to live and work in New York City. So I spent the rest of my time in Storm Lake working for the town newspaper. And I will say, you know, shout out to the Storm Lake Times and what was then the Pilot Tribune. They're now a combo pack. But it really taught me the value of what a story means. You know, we had a daily newspaper and sometimes you would just call people in town up and be like, hey, Sally, do you want to be in the paper tomorrow? She's like, for what? And you'd be like, gosh, I don't know. Let's have coffee and figure it out. And you just realized if you took the time to listen to folks and ask that everybody has a really incredible story. Mm-hmm. And if they're going to trust it to you, you better be giving it 125% integrity and respect because you only get one. And so what a blessing it is to be a vehicle to share it. And so I ended up going to school for journalism, really thought I either wanted to write for a newspaper or work in PR. The newspaper medium started to evolve. And so I did an internship in public relations in New York City when I was in college, came back and really wanted to move out of Iowa, really wanted to move to New York and was home for a little bit and ended up starting to work on a movie set. Iowa had a big film tax incentive. And for the next 6 months after that, I was sort of a coordinator for the state of Iowa working on these movie sets. And right before I was set to move to New York, that very first movie director I ever worked for called and asked me to help her with a short premiere project out in LA. And I'd never been. She's like, come on out. You can stay for free if you help me out for a couple of weeks. I'm like, sounds like free vacation. Love that.
Yeah.
And before I left, she sat me down and said, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't tell you that I'm sure you'll be great in PR if you go, but I think you're supposed to work in entertainment and I'd like to hire you to be my assistant. And I was 22 and I thought, gosh, New York will still be there. And so got in my car, moved to Los Angeles, and that was nearly 15 years ago now. And worked for her for a little bit, started working in television. Shortly thereafter, found my way into development, which is, you know, the ideation phase of things. It's a, like to say it's the buffet of production. You know, we get to be out in the field. We get to be sourcing stories. We get to be talking to people. We get to be taking meetings. We get to be in post. It's a little bit of all of it. And it really played into my journalistic background. And so that's where I've stayed. But yeah, it's rare. Usually when we develop something, a lot of times we give it to somebody else to sort of take and become their baby. And this one I really stayed with through and through for the past 2 years. So it's, it was a real wonder. It was a really wonderful experience to sort of get to be with it that full time that way.
Yeah, but, get to hold on to it instead of passing it along.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, that's cool. That's a heck of a journey there. I mean, Iowa to New York and then Iowa to LA. That's got to be worlds apart right there, buddy.
You know what it is? And it's funny. I think I spent 18 years of my life thinking about how am I going to get out of here? And now as I get older, you know, I appreciate going home so much more. All of that, you grow up thinking, gosh, you know, everybody's in your business and whatnot. And you're like, it turns out I think they're just supportive and nice, you know. But as a kid, you don't have room to appreciate that. So yeah. I feel like I get the best of both worlds. I sort of all worlds, actually. I get to bop over to New York for work quite a bit. And I do love New York City, and I get to travel for this job and tell incredible stories. And home is always there waiting for me, you know, when I go back. And that's really beautiful too. I'm really grateful for the way I grew up and the wonderful family and friends I have there.
Yeah. I love New York, man. I've had a chance to travel up there with the podcast a few times and interview some individuals. And I absolutely love New York. Like, I've never had the opportunity to live there, but I swear, even if it was just for like 6 months, I would love to just live up there and experience that every day. And like, my wife, she's like, there's no way I couldn't do it. She's very much just like, too many people give her anxiety. And I'm just like, I'm just the opposite. I'm like, I love it. I love the nonstop crazy, yep. Go, go, go. Everything's, you know, always open. You can walk out on a street corner at 2 a.m. and find a hot dog or whatever it is you're looking for. I mean, I love it. So yeah, I understand what you're saying on that. It's a whole different vibe up there. It really is.
It is. I did that internship up there for a full summer semester. And I mean, little baby Ashley thought she just walked out of the movie Sex and the City. I didn't think my life was ever getting any cooler. And, you know, I had an 11 block walk to work every day. And I always said, you know, New York's alive in a way that you walk the same 11 blocks and every single day something changed. It was alive in a different way than it was the day before. Mm-hmm. And although I'm so grateful for the opportunity I have out here, you know, New York always will have such a place in my heart because of that. It's a special city.
Right. So tell us, obviously you make plans to go, what was it? The Harvest Festival? Is that what they called it?
Yeah. So it was the Route 91 Harvest Festival.
Okay.
And I believe it's in its fifth year. We had gone every year. It's what we did for our anniversary. My husband and I, we were very different people, and we really connected over country music. And so he was from Las Vegas originally. So this is something we always did. And, you know, if you ask anyone, they will tell you it was the best music festival until it wasn't. Right. It, you know, a lot of times you think of music festivals, you think about, you know, I grew up in the Midwest. So music festivals to me were like, go out in a cornfield, we throw up some tents, and like everyone walks with it, and you're just dusty and dirty and hot and sweaty for days on end. And we have our own version of that in California with Coachella and Stagecoach and things like that. It's not, I wouldn't call it, you know, it's not convenience. Like, it's fun, but it's not, it's different. And I think what was so special about this is you have this venue with like the beauty of the Las Vegas Strip in the background, and your hotel was right across the street. And so you could walk over, you could see a show if you wanted to take a break because you were warm, you go back to the hotel room. If you wanted to go out to dinner, you go out to dinner. You needed a break, go in and, you know, gamble a little bit or go to one of the museums or the shows. Like, there was just so much to do. And truly, you know, I watch it often as it almost chokes me up talking about it. That's how clear the memory is in my head. The night prior, Lee Bryce, I'll never forget him singing, I Drive Your Truck, which is this a beautiful song that he sings, a slower song. And looking back from the fourth row of that show, we stood in the same spot, every year, every single night. We're about four or five rows back on the right-hand side of the stage, and turning around and looking at that sea of cell phone lights and the strip in the background. And it's as if the strip was dead silent and you just heard this beautiful song and saw all of these people just enjoying a warm night and a cold beverage and like all singing in unison together. And there's something really special about country music in that way. It was this prolific moment sort of followed by this very tragic moment that would be to come. But yeah, it was those organizers did a brilliant job with that. And no one could have predicted what could have happened, and they certainly, you know, prepared themselves for it. But there's no preparing, a true preparing for something of this nature. So I always say, you know, my heart really is with all of those people who planned that festival, because it was a beautiful job, and it's really just too bad that someone took that away. Because there was a lot of people, you know, again, you ask any survivor, they will tell you first things first, it was the best music fest. Like, it was the best time.
Yeah. And it looked like it was very well, like, centered in place, like you said, in the middle of the strip. You could tell all that from the documentary. It was just really cool looking. And we have a thing similar to that here in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. They call it the Carolina Country Music Festival. So they set up a big stage. The beach is right behind them. When it gets dark, like, you have the lights of the hotels on the beach strip there. So it's similar. It doesn't have the high rise, you know, building casinos and things like Vegas, but I can just picture that, as you were saying, how beautiful that probably would have been to look at. And then you have that, you know, the wonderful night, like you said, with Lee Bryce. And then obviously Jason Aldean. Was this the last night? Was this the last night of the festival?
Yeah. So Jason was the final performer. And I want to say he was also the final performer of the very first year too. Mm-hmm. And so it was this really cool moment, and everyone was still so excited. Like, it was this, you know, still, it's crazy. Like, 3 days in, you know, it's, again, it's a country music crowd. So there had been plenty of, like, beer and whiskey drinking all weekend.
Oh yeah.
And,
oh yeah.
You know, it's Vegas. So it's toasty out there. So if you're getting to, you know, 10 o'clock on Sunday night and your crowd is still rowdy and ready to go, like, that's it was still that, like, wild energy,
that's saying something, because I'm sure they've been there since sometimes maybe Thursday and then Friday.
Oh, yeah.
You know, prepping and pregaming. Yeah.
Yep. For sure.
And so how long was he into his set before this tragedy started unfolding?
Yeah. So he was a couple of songs in, you know, and I didn't really realize until we started really putting together the timeline, and we really worked with the Metro PD and actually all of the ambulance services that received 911 calls to make sure that our timeline was accurate and to note when certain things started. Definitely different people heard different things based on where you were.
Right.
You know, for me, I didn't know that it had started until he was singing a song called When She Says Baby. It was, and I know it well because it was my favorite song at the time. Mm-hmm. But we did, you know, later really find out that there were some initial shots that came at the song prior, which was Any Old Bar Stool.
Right.
And, you know, that was sort of notated as we talked to the FBI and the SWAT team that he was actually trying to shoot at the tanks that were over at the airport in the attempt to create an explosion. And then that plan wasn't working for him. And so then it turned into something different. Okay. But yeah, it truly, you know, I remember hearing a couple of pops and looking over at Sean and saying, you know, gosh, what do you think that is? Do you think someone brought fireworks in here? And again, like, it wasn't an outlandish thought. It had been a country festival full of drinking. Stupid, yes. Crazy, no. And he said maybe, you know, we're very close to the speaker, maybe an amp's blowing. Mm-hmm. And I turned back to the stage to take a photo and turned back to him to say, oh my gosh, isn't this amazing? And I watched the person directly behind him be shot straight through the face. And I dropped my phone and grabbed his shoulders and I ripped him down. And he did not, I mean, he was not receptive to that at that moment. You know, he didn't see what I saw.
Right.
And so he, you know, what are you doing? And I said, we got to get down. You know, someone has a gun in here. And I, you know, just remember holding his face and saying, like, don't turn your face. And you know, at that moment, it was probably, you know, another couple seconds before Jason ran off. And then all of the lights came on and you really started to see what was going on around you, and everybody got down, and it's interesting. Everyone really like wove together immediately, like this human quilt, like it's weird to say, it was almost animalistic nature. I feel, you know, you realize that if your legs were on someone's head and you got shot in the leg, you might live. If you realize that, you know, you put your stomach on top of everyone just worked to sort of protect each other, you know, and protect each other's faces and major organs. And so there was a woman who was laying on top of me, and I was saying, gosh, every prayer I know. And I looked over and I saw Sean take his phone and do this. And I said, please put that, and, you know, at that moment we thought, because it was so loud, you know, Jason's mic pack was actually still on. And so it was so loud because all of the gunshots were reverbing over every speaker system still at that point. And so we made the assumption that it must be, you know, 10 people with machine guns walking through. And I looked at him and I said, oh my gosh, you need to like put that down. Like we don't need to remember, like, please put that down. Like we need to pretend to be dead. Like, and that's what we needed to do. And he looked at me so clearly and said, you know, no, we need to figure out what's going on. We're going to get out of here. And he just had a conviction on his face and brought it down. And there was about 8 of us. And what we could see, because the ground was level, is that there weren't people walking through. And so he looked at me and said, you know, in the next break, because at that point we had been through 3 or 4 rounds and we knew that there was breaking. In the next break, we're going to get up and run. And the woman on top of me said, you know, I'm a former first responder. We need to stay down. And that was as close to a professional opinion as I certainly had at that moment. And he said, there's one of two things that are going to happen here tonight, Ashley. And like, I would like for us to try to get out of here. And I knew at that moment, it truly did not actually matter if I thought we should go or not. We were going to be going. Mm-hmm. I'm really grateful for that. And so in the next, you know, we said all of the things to each other. We said all of the things to those two ladies that were there. And in the next break, we got up to go. And I very quickly caught my boot on someone else and tripped. And we were separated, you know, by about 10 feet. He flew forward because he had my arm hard trying to pull me up out of the sea of people. And for the next round, we were just watching each other. And, you know, it was admittedly, you know, the worst moment of all of it, because you just realize how helpless you are. There was nothing I could do to make any of that better. And you just realized you might watch someone you love die in front of you. And
were you guys running during the rounds? Because when you say breaks, for people that don't know, like when the guy was firing, he would fire until he run out of whatever he was using. Then obviously he would reload and start again. So there was intermittent breaks in between there. Were you guys actually running while he started back firing again?
Yes. So when we stayed down while the firing was going on that moment. I don't think we realized, and I certainly don't think anyone else realized, that laying down was probably not, we didn't fully know what was going on or where it was coming from yet. So,
right. Nobody really had a grasp of where this was coming from. And even watching the documentary, because everything's kind of in the center with these big hotels around them, the echoes, you can't tell where it's coming from. There's no possible way.
No. And you didn't know, was someone going to be around the corner? Or was this multiple? In our head, the only thing we really had to compare this to was 9/11. So it felt like anytime you turn a corner, there could be someone waiting for you. So we stayed down, but admittedly, we were probably making ourselves bigger targets by laying down. When it stopped again, we got up and ran and made it to the far end of the field. We had always gone in the vendor entrance, or always exited the vendor exit. The very first year, our Uber accidentally dropped us off in the wrong place. And the security guard at the vendor entrance felt bad for me. I had terrible shoes on. And he was like, you can go in, but like, you can't ever come in here again, like this way. But we were always able to go out that way. It was sort of our way of beating the crowd on the way out. So we ran towards that vendor exit. And it wasn't until we really hit the pavement outside of the sort of GA area, which was a turf ground, that I started falling quite a bit. As it turns out, cowboy boots are very, very bad running shoes, and everyone had dropped food and drink. So it felt like an ice skating rink. Right. So in the next round, we stopped behind a cement barrier. We had pulled a couple of girls in with us and were kind of tucked in, and I made the decision to take off those shoes. We then ran about 3.5 miles down the strip, intermittently stopping when shooting would start, ducking behind things we thought could be helpful. Ran down to a condo complex that was sort of attached to the Planet Hollywood. I had pretty bad road rash on my legs. I had denim shorts on, nothing crazy, but it was bleeding, and someone saw it and said, you know, there's medical attention inside. And we went in and, you know, were there for probably 5 minutes before someone dropped a glass and they yelled shooter again. While we were in there, we had briefly seen like it start to come on the news what was going on. So we took off running again. We saw a couple go upstairs and I said, we should follow them. And he's like, no, we have to get outside. Again, we in our head imagined at any moment, you know, there was rumors that there was bombs outside of the Excalibur, that Vegas was going to be leveled at any second. And so he's like, you know, we need to get outside. And I was like, no, there's only one reason you go upstairs right now. And it's because you have a car, because it's a parking garage. Mm-hmm. And we ran upstairs, and sure enough, that couple got into a car and we threw ourselves on their windshield. And the man, rightfully so, in a very angry fashion, got out and said, you know, get off of my car. And we said, you know, there is a terrorist attack going on. You can save our life. Please help us. And God bless Ben and Jackie, who are no longer strangers. They let us into their back seat and we all drove off the strip together. They had driven from Ontario, California. And when they told us that, you know, we asked if they would drive us back to Ontario, and we rode back, you know, about 3.5 hours with them. About an hour in, we would stop to use the bathroom, and I realized my arm was broken from falling during one of those moments on the cement. But that's how much adrenaline is going through your body. Like I didn't even feel that until I went to, you know, go push a car door open, and 2 hours after it had happened. So we ended up getting back to LA at around 7:30 in the morning the next morning. And, you know, I remember sitting watching the news and thinking that it was so terrible, but it, you know, I think I remember thinking we were going to flip on the news. And again, that, you know, the whole city had been leveled after we left, you know, it felt that terrifying and that big. And, because of like all of the rumors, because people were, you know, calling in victims from every casino in town, because people were running in with gunshot wounds or, you know, wounds from falling. They had to assume that there were shooters at every single one of those venues. So it was just a happenstance of the chaos of the response, but,
and understandable. Yeah. That's very understandable when you have different people running into these casinos. If I'm a front desk clerk and I see people run in with injuries and being shot, I'm going to think it probably happened right outside, not, you know, way down here at this concert. So when they're going to call the police and say, we've got a person here shot, another casino is going to do the same thing. So that's, like you said, just a weird chain of events that just really, it kind of had law enforcement running all over the place and not being able to focus in on the key area of what was going on, but that's to no fault of their own. I mean, it was just the situation at hand.
Yeah. And, you know, you've seen the piece now. So I've got, you know, we were also very lucky that Jesus Campos, the gentleman working security, came across what was going on the 32nd floor. You know, there were 1,100 rounds dispelled in those 11 minutes. But what, you know, people may not know is there were 5,000 additional rounds found in that hotel room. What happened that night could have been five times worse had he not have began to distract the shooter from what was going on, and also be able to call in SWAT to the exact location of where he was. And so really bad, but could have been really, really, really bad. You know, it is.
And he himself almost wound up getting, becoming a victim, because I believe the individual had cameras set up where he could see from the outside. He could see down the hallways. So he seen Mr. Campos coming up there, and he did fire at him, barely missed him. And, to sit here and think.
Jesus was shot.
Jesus, he did get shot. Okay.
He did get shot. And, you're absolutely right. He did have those cameras set up. He was prepared to, as we spoke with the FBI, it really is ruled as a suicide wrapped in a mass shooting. That person did not intend to leave that hotel room alive. And so you've got someone who, was calculated, but also desperate to complete whatever this mission he had, in his head was. And so, like I said, the moment he began to get distracted, he's not only not shooting into that crowd, he's shooting down into the hallway, but it's also allowing, SWAT the opportunity to have a location and also make their way up there to stop what's going on as quickly as possible.
And thank goodness his shot wasn't fatal, because had it been fatal, then there would have still been, that would have allowed more time for him to continue wreaking the havoc there. Once you guys were back, you're watching all this unfold on the news. What's running through your mind? Is it that, I can't believe it? Is this real? You thinking this is a dream? What's going through your mind? It's got to be all sorts of emotions.
Yeah. I think, that entire drive back, I obviously am talking to family members, from home who are waking up to the news, and I very, very aware now. I'm not sure if I was aware then, but especially in that car ride home, that I was really, truly in shock. Mm-hmm. And, getting home and really preparing to go to the, I knew I needed to go to the hospital. I clearly knew by the pain in my arm that my arm was broke. And so just, preparing to take yourself into a public atmosphere and an atmosphere that hadn't just experienced what you'd experienced. I was walking into Cedars-Sinai, that I wasn't walking into Sunrise, who had just seen, 200 plus patients and knew what was going on. I was walking in at, now what would have been close to 9 a.m. in LA, and feeling very out of place. Like, how am I even supposed to feel that this happened to us, but also, that we made it home? We didn't have our stuff, but we didn't care. A couple of days later, I was set to get on a flight. It was my sister's 30th birthday, and she was having a big family thing. And so it was a lot of emotion. And I think, just an overwhelming gratitude, but also, I'll call it a deep confusion, because no one puts their shoes on the morning thinking, like, these are the shoes I'm going to run for my life in.
Right.
And no one goes to a concert thinking you're going to be in a mass shooting. It's still so hard in so many ways to wrap your brain around. And I think, especially, I'll never forget watching the first edit cut of the very first episode, and really seeing it all backed up against each other for it's the first time that what I remembered was represented visually in that way. And I did realize, I remember sitting there that night and really having a good, deep, visceral cry, because it's impossible to explain to someone. You can say it scared the life out of, it was horrific, but those words aren't enough to describe what it was.
Yeah.
And so I remember turning on the news that morning and thinking, until they announced the number of injured, that it didn't feel like enough. Like, that we saw so much chaos, and it felt again, it felt like we were about to witness what was Las Vegas's version of 9/11. And mm-hmm. so I just can't say any of it really added up. And I think for a long time, a lot of the pieces for me personally didn't come together. I became weirdly obsessed with getting those cowboy boots back. That became my very strange, like unsettling obsession, which I really wouldn't understand until 9 months later, an FBI agent delivered them to my front door, which was a wild experience in and of itself. And that really was what launched the idea for 11 minutes. As it turns out, there is a unit of the FBI that was created all of volunteer agents who go and collect the items from mass acts of violence. And their goal is to return them if they are wanted to family members of survivors and victims. And so I, believe it or not, those boots that I took off in the middle of that field that night came home to me 9 months later. And when I opened that box, I just thought in my head, gosh, you know, here is the last piece of me that was there coming back. But also each item in this, you know, catalog of items that I'm looking at right now belongs to an incredible human being who went through something unfathomable. And that's a story that deserves to be told. And so that really was the launch of 11 minutes. But I will say, you know, especially that first year, it's confusing when you come back. And you, for me, I'm a lemonade in the lemons kind of girl. Mm-hmm. And I found myself just thinking the worst of humanity. And it took me a long time to circle back to, you know, people really are, I believe, born good. And hearing all of those stories this past couple years, it's a reminder, I think, you know, people have capabilities to do evil things, but I truly believe that we are all born good and with the ability in nature to want to protect each other and care for each other. I think there's other stuff that gets in the way of that or tells us otherwise, but I do really believe that. And I'm really glad, you know, that I was able to find that again.
Yeah, I can, you were spot on there. And you mentioned this was at a concert, not somewhere you would expect this kind of stuff to happen. I mean, even 9/11 was just, you know, it was targeted to the World Trade Center. It was on, I think it was a Tuesday, you know, middle of the morning. So that's just the average work day. And obviously that's going to catch people off guard too. But this is something that, you know, had never happened to this point in time to where everybody gets together. That's a time where everybody's like left their cares away. You know, nobody's thinking about work. Everybody's there. They're listening to music. They're, you know, I guess guards or senses are down. And, you know, it had to just change you forever. And I mean, what was it like the next time you had the opportunity to go to an event like that or to a concert, were you apprehensive? I mean, how did that change you in that regard?
Yeah, it's interesting. I had a colleague from work, reach out to me a month to the day later. We had gotten tickets to see a show in Hollywood together. And she said, you know, gosh, I felt so bad, you know, not reminding you of this. And then she's like, and then I felt terrible reminding you of this. And I'm assuming you don't want to go, but like, I didn't know what to do here. So I'm calling you and telling you that we bought these tickets. Do you want to go? Do you not want to, like, but let me know. And I really thought about it. And I love live music. I sing like a dying cat. It's not cute. I've always had such respect for people who have musical talent. And truly my happy place since being very young is I love being outdoors and listening to good music. And country holds my heart just because of where I grew up. And I thought about that and I called her back and I said, you know, Sarah, I said, I'm not going to promise it'll be perfect, but if you're down, I'd love to try to go to the show. I said, I think if we go early and I walk around and maybe I stand by a door and you don't have to stand with me, but like, maybe if I do this, like I, can do this, but I know that I got something that 58 other people didn't that night. And I think it was truly at that moment that I really revowed to live big, brave, and boldly on behalf of the miracle that I received. You know, who am I to spite a miracle? That's going to shows like that is something that's always made me feel alive. And I was not going to let that person take that away from me. Like, I got to live, so I was going to go live. And it was not comfortable. You know, it was really uncomfortable, that first show. And it was wonderful to be with friends, and I was nervous, and then I got through it. And it was a while until I probably really started to truly be able to enjoy shows again. And I'll never go to a concert or a event the same way. I'm a person who sits on the aisle. I'm now a person who checks in with security to see if there's going to be pyrotechnics so that I can be emotionally prepared for them, because I have absolutely fully hit the ground in the middle of a firework at a show. You know, it's for me, not knowing where sounds are coming from is a challenge, mm-hmm. Still to this day. But I think it's about informing yourself and, you know, just knowing what is. You know, I experienced something traumatic, so I try not to get down on myself that when I go to an event, I'm so grateful that we have, you know, all of the things I think maybe other people get a little annoyed at, like, give me those metal detectors, give me the security, you know, security guards. I'm here for the extra checks. Like, let's work to keep each other safe. And right. If that takes a few extra minutes for us to get into a venue, so be it. I promise it is worth every single minute spent doing that. And so, yeah, it's different for me now, but I'm still a person who loves going to concerts, and I really, you know, I hope I always will be. Like I said, and maybe as a stubborn part of me, that person wasn't going to take that away from me. And I feel happy that through therapy and mental health care and learning how to make myself aware and feel prepared and better in those situations, that I'm able to go and do that. Cause I know that everybody is not so lucky, and that there are still, you know, people who really, really struggle with that and really have a hard time with that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that can go both ways. Some people will be, you know, have the notion to never want to do things like that again. But I think it's really remarkable that you look at it as, like you said, that it is a miracle that you were able to make it through that. And, you know, what would be the point of making it through that and never living your life? And that's easier said than done, for sure, 100%. But, you know, like you said, it didn't start off the easiest, but progressively it gets a little easier. You know, it's almost like having to learn something all over again, learning to adapt to being in large crowds. And like you said, finding out, are they going to do pyrotechnics, or are they going to do, you know, fireworks at some point, so you can be prepared for it. But I mean, yeah. Kudos to you for not, you know, letting that keep you in a box. And if anybody's listening, you know, to when we reference this individual, we never say his name. And there's a reason. Why don't you kind of clue our audience in on why you made this decision to never mention his name? Because it was very powerful.
Yeah, I think every survivor and individual that was interviewed for this piece, whether they were a part of the piece or they were, you know, they shared their story at some, any point, even as far as the police, who obviously, or FBI, who are very procedural in individuals, you know, this sentiment through and through is that that person does not deserve the breath that is in our lungs. You know, it sadly wasn't shocking when we spoke with the FBI, when they talked about how, you know, he had searches on his computer about how to be famous on social media. And I think, again, the media, and I know there is a necessity in reporting certain things, but time and time again, we see this notion from people that they are trying to leave a legacy or, you know, be notarized in history, whatever it might be, on what is, you know, their sort of last whim or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I had talked to the team really early on and shared that this was a sentiment of the community. And I said, I don't know how everyone's going to approach it. And everyone is free to approach it however they want. But just so you know, like the community at large, really, we don't say his name. And you talk about the greatest, in some ways, surprise. Like it still chokes me up to this day because I had a really incredible team. And I think it's important to recognize, you know, I was a survivor of this event, but all of these individuals who worked on this project sat in day in and day out and heard these hard stories. They watched this hard footage. Editors watched this footage on repeat for months and months and months, putting this together and working to do so in an authentic way. And that is not easy in its own way. That is very mentally challenging. And when I was shown the cut of episode 4, which I'm so proud. A lot of times we don't get the opportunity in media to tell the story that comes after the story. And mm-hmm. Paramount Plus commissioned 3 episodes, and we actually were given a 4th episode to do that so that we could honor the community, honor and pay tribute to the victims and their families. And additionally, you know, there's a very haunting scroll at the end that is there to remind people that since October 1, 2017, since that big headline of our nation's largest mass shooting, there are so many more of these that have happened. And it's a 6.5-minute scroll that is at the end of the piece. And it really hits you. But truly the thing that I'll never forget is the day I was sent the first cut to that edit. And not only did we take a stance in the piece to not ever say the shooter's name from this particular event, when we referenced the epidemic that is mass shootings in our country, we removed shooter's names and that shooter's names from those media pieces. And it felt, as a survivor, like taking a little bit of power back. And I hope that the community felt that in a way too, but also truly it felt like an example that we could give the media, because we don't have to say the name. We do not have to give what is desired from these individuals. And perhaps by not doing that, we in our own way can aid in the fight for this to not be such a consistent headline. And I thought it was a powerful example. And as a stylistic choice, I was really, really proud that that is something that we were able to do. Really proud of that. Really proud of that. And I hope it will be utilized as an example as other people approach hard subject matter of this nature.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, that's what a lot of these people are wanting. They're wanting their name attached to whatever event that they do, whatever horrific idea that in their mind makes logical sense. How that can happen, I don't know. But that is the goal. And so in a sense, it's able to kind of give a middle finger back to that person. We're not even going to acknowledge, you know, your name or your existence with this. You know, this is about the people that banded together, the memory of the people that unfortunately didn't make it. We're going to highlight the people that really matter in this whole situation.
And not only that, we are going to remove you from the narrative, you know, and that, like I said, that, you know, people often joke, you know, in media, they'll say things like, gosh, you know, we don't do brain surgery for a living, mm-hmm. but I encourage people to remember that what we do is prolific. We are the individuals who get to write the history books, and we are the only people with the power to rewrite them correctly. And so in some ways, that's what I felt like we got to do with 11 minutes. You know, I feel like all of that feeling that all of those people had about the fact that that was the story that was represented is not only did we switch the point of view from the darkness to the light, but we further just removed it from the situation in general. And that felt right.
Yeah. And we mentioned earlier, you did, you even did get Jason Aldean and some of his band on there. The guy, the DJ that he was with, you know, had a daughter in very close proximity to one of the rooms to where the shooter was. I mean, all kinds of, you know, intricate details that you guys dive into. Was Jason pretty open to doing this? Was he a little reluctant? I mean, what was his feelings about, you know, hopping on this? Because I know it's kind of like when you have a celebrity attached to them, they kind of become not necessarily the focal point, but the face of it. You know, how was his feelings about doing this? Was he pretty open to it?
Yeah, I think our approach, you know, I think about Jason often, because we were very close to the stage, and I know what we saw in our proximity. And I think in so many ways, he had the worst view in the house, and those lights were on, and that's his job. And he is a very talented musician. And I can't imagine what it is like to now get on stage every night and wonder what that person's doing when they put their hand in their pocket, or, you know, there's a weird sound. Like I always felt like if we were so lucky that he would step in and share his story, which he hadn't done in an extensive way, if he were to trust us, that what I and what the team really wanted him to know was that he is a survivor of this event. He's not here or being asked in this particular instance to be a figurehead,
right?
But instead to step into the survivor community and to feel and be vulnerable in that way. And he really was. And we're really appreciative, because his perspective was an important one. You know, and, DJ Silver's, you know, story is incredible. And, you know, God bless his nanny who was with his son Wake. And I'm so happy they all, you know, were safe and reunited. And their perspective was an important one. And I'm glad that they chose to share it. It, you know, you mentioned it as well. It was important to us to have representation from it all at large. And it was a really big event. And I think our only, if we could say we had one regret, was that we couldn't tell the story of all 22,000 people that were there, because every single one, even to this day, when I meet new people, you know, everyone went through something extraordinary that night and is surviving something extraordinary now. And so I am glad that we got to share their perspective, and grateful that they felt comfortable to do that with us. Grateful.
And even going in detail, I mean, he talked about when they were on the tour bus, like they were getting down, they were crawling, there was bullet holes, you know, in some of their tour buses. And that kind of puts things into perspective to where it doesn't matter if you are a member of law enforcement, there is security. If you are a patron of the concert, if you are the headlining act performing, when something like this happens, everybody is, you know, automatically brought down to the same playing field. You're trying to survive. You're trying to look out for your fellow man, fellow woman, and just help each other out. And, you know, it's, you know, bullets, unfortunately, no individual people, they go where they go. And that guy fired a lot of them. And, you know, it's crazy that you can say we were so lucky that only 58, you know, were victims. But like you said, it could have been so much more.
It could have. And, you know, I Stormy Warren also really, you know, shared his prolific story with us. And I think, you know, from that sort of celebrity perspective, you know, he brought something to light. I think oftentimes as leaders, or as personalities, or however you want to identify people who are, you know, in the spotlight, there's this pressure that you have to be okay.
Yeah.
Because other people are looking to you to be okay. And Stormy was really very vulnerable and shared about his time going back to the highway, you know, the next day after that, and showing up to work and trying to put on the okay face, and realizing as people just showed up to the door of the radio station because they knew he had been there, that in fact, pretending to be okay when you're not is the least helpful thing you can do. In fact, everyone was just looking for someone else to say, this isn't okay, and we're not okay right now. And so I think in a lot of ways, you know, I'm also very, very proud that we were able to share that perspective, that, you know, it doesn't matter who you are. Doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. You know, I often think a lot of times, and I'm really grateful to, you know, the Las Vegas Metro PD in particular for their vulnerability. And, you know, I think I'm a girl with seven brothers. So I feel like I'm going to say that oftentimes, particularly men, walk away feeling like it's not okay to not be okay, or it's not okay to cry. And I remember sitting there interviewing these police officers who were very emotional. Mm-hmm. And I was never afraid to be emotional when I was around any of them, because I had my therapist said to me once, it would be far more abnormal for all of you to pretend like this was okay than to actually just admit that it wasn't. And so I, in so many ways, and I think whether it was Jason or DJ or Stormy or the police officers or SWAT, or, you know, the individuals who were on the ground or the medical teams, the fact that everybody could vulnerably say out loud to the rest of the United States of America, this wasn't okay, and we aren't okay about it, was, I hope that it gives people some license, because there's no guidebook for dummies on how to go through something like this,
right?
To feel okay when you're not okay, you know, yeah. And that there is help out there for that, and opportunity out there for that. And there's someone else out there who feels a little bit of what you're feeling. Cause it can be really lonely and isolating, I think, to go through something like this.
Oh, 100%. Mental health is key, because, you know, you are a survivor of this event, but then you have the survivor's guilt is a real thing in some cases. And then you deal with that. And then, you know, the mindset of, like you said, trying to reacclimate yourself to being able to go to public places. Those are all things you need help with. And you're absolutely right. I think men especially, you know, wear that, I guess, badge that, you know, nothing bothers them, or they're not bothered by certain things, or they can handle it. That's usually always the saying you'll get, oh, I can handle it, or I'll get through it. I mean, you might, but you might can get through it easier if you reached out for help. And that's why I think mental health is something that really needs to be driven home in all aspects of life, not just in a tragedy like this, but especially when it's something of this magnitude and of this nature. Those are things that you will never forget. Like in some cases, I'll never forget 9/11, seeing those visual images on TV as long as I live. And I wasn't in New York. I can imagine someone in your situation, the visual images that you've, you know, talked about here with me today, those are never going to leave you either. You know, those will always be with you. So you have to figure out a way to cope with them, because they're not going to leave.
Yeah. And I agree with you. And I think so often about the day that person had, you know, before they walked upstairs and did what they did. And I often wonder if had they have had a different interaction at any point in their life, you know, would it have changed it? And mm-hmm. People always say to me, you know, what can we do to change things? What, you know, how can we make the headline stop? And, you know, I know people can get really lost in big conversations. But I always say, like, I hope what people take away from this and feel compelled to change is I hope that they watch this and know the value. And as crazy as it seems that love can really change anything. I hope that people are kinder to one another. You know, if you see someone upset, say something. If you see someone sitting by themselves, go sit with them. It, you know, strike up conversation, put your phone down, strike up a conversation in line with someone. You know, I think there's a lot of things that need to change. And I think that, you know, some of those things feel so unattainable that people get frozen about it. But the thing everybody can do right now is be kinder and be a better neighbor, because I believe that people who feel loved and seen do not go commit mass acts of violence. And so, you know, it seems so small, but it really has the power to change everything. And so I am a huge advocate for mental health care, and staying on top of it and getting ahead of it. And I see it every day, but I hope the shame and stigma that comes along with, you know, being in therapy goes away fully, because life is hard. And I think it's okay to, you know, if we had a cough, we wouldn't, and it stuck around for a month, we wouldn't not go to the doctor.
Right.
So I hope that stigma around mental health care versus physical health care continues to alter, because I do think it'll lead us to be a kinder society. And I do think that that's really where things start to change.
And you're absolutely right. You know, who knows? I think in all these situations, everybody's going to always look back and say, well, what if this would have happened? What if that was happened? But you're absolutely right. Had maybe someone shown interest in, if this individual was suffering for something or for some reason, if someone would have talked to him about it, struck up a conversation about it, and not just in this instance, you know, there's many others that we've kind of, you know, glossed over here, all these mass shootings. You never know what one conversation from a person could have done. They could have said, oh, well, there are good people, and it just changed their mindset. And, you know, this whole thing could have been diverted. So I think that's a great message and a great way to end this show. You know, if you see someone out there that you can tell is having a rough time, reach out to them. You know, it doesn't take but a minute to go over and just have a conversation, check on someone. This includes people you already know. It doesn't have to be a friend. You know, a lot of times I think we get caught up, and I'm guilty of this myself, we get caught up in everything that we have going on. I always say there's not enough time in the day. But if you see someone's acting different, especially if you know they went through some sort of life-changing event, be it a divorce or something like that, reach out, check on them, just make sure they're doing okay. Tell them just let them know you're there. Lots of times people don't take you up on it. It's just the way we are in society. But just sometimes just letting them know that you're there means more than you will ever know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, there's no excuse for these acts. But I think, you know, if you dive into any of these individuals' backstory, as the news often does, you'll see that these are hurt people who choose to hurt people. And so, again, I think, you know, it's in our own way, as we hopefully, you know, look forward and continue to fight on each other's behalf for other changes, that's something that's within all of our power to make a better world on a daily basis, starting right now. So that's what I hope people take away, is that, you know, kindness and bravery, it doesn't just change lives. It really does have the power to save them.
Absolutely. Well, we wish you the best on the Emmy. I hope you win. I'll be following that closely, see if you guys can pull out the win there. I'll definitely be pulling for you. Do you have any other projects coming down the pipe that you'd like to talk about before we get out of here?
You know, we are working on it right now, but, you know, it is 11 minutes is something that I think touched so many people that it has become a bit of a goal for Paramount Plus to continue to shine a light on the stories of survivors. And so they recently released a press release noting that we are working on a piece surrounding the crowd crush that happened in Seoul last Halloween. And mm-hmm. So we're working on a piece to share some survivor stories and the light that was in the darkness there. So it's, you know, for us, we hope to continue to do good things and tell these stories that, like I said, you know, just shift the point of view from that of the negative to the positive that was inside of that. Not that it's not important to share the history at large, but you know, just to really take a different point of view on these mass casualty events.
Those stories that get lost, kind of like what we said, you know, lots of times the survivors, you know, have a lot of stuff they deal with. The main focus is on, you know, the perpetrator or the shooter or whoever caused it. Sometimes those people kind of get left out. And this is kind of what we just talked about is, you know, interviewing these people, being able to let them tell their story, let people understand what they went through, again, could be that piece that they need to help them get through this. So I think you're on the right track here, and we wish you nothing but success going forward.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you tend to gravitate and want to be what you can see. And so I hope that we spend a little less time in our media and social media talking about people who shouldn't have a light shone on them, and talk a little bit more about everyday people and people stepping up to be heroes and doing wonderful things, because I've got to imagine that seeing that will only inspire more of that.
Absolutely. 100%. Well, Ashley, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And yeah, thanks everyone in advance for watching and for listening. Listen to me talk, I suppose.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, you heard it right here. Go check out 11 Minute, streaming right now on Paramount Plus. I guarantee you will come away with a whole different perspective of everything that, you know, all these individuals went through. You know, it was a really moving documentary. I definitely recommend it. Again, we wish you guys nothing but the best going forward. Wish you luck on the Emmys. And that will do it for this episode. I'm Hollywood Wade. That was Ashley Hoff. And unfortunately, we are out of time. So tune in next week for an all-new episode of Crime and Entertainment. Ashley, we appreciate it.
Thanks so much, everyone. Take care. Be kind.
Well, boy, oh boy, we hope everyone enjoyed that episode. Really, really deep emotional stuff there. I urge all of you guys, go out, check out 11 Minute streaming on Paramount Plus. Definitely worth a look if you have not seen it. Also, I encourage you to please like and subscribe on the YouTube. Hit that notification bell. That way you get notified every time we drop a video. Also on the audio side of things, Google, Stitcher, Apple, Spotify, the whole nine yards. We're everywhere you can get your podcast. Please like, subscribe, rate, review, anything you can do to help bump us up the charts. And of course, all the social medias, Instagram, Crime, the letter N, and Entertainment, Facebook, Crime, the and symbol, and Entertainment, and TikTok's Crime and AND Entertainment. So please share the show. That really helps get the word out. A free way to help out old Hollywood and Crime and Entertainment here. So we appreciate you guys listening. We hope everyone enjoyed this episode. I don't know how you couldn't just be on the edge of your seat listening to this. We'd like to give a big thank you for Ashley Hoff for coming on. And that will do it for this episode of Crime and Entertainment. I'm Hollywood Wade. That was Ashley Hoff. We'll see you next week.